Welcome to a series of podcasts brought to you by Yale University.
In this lecture, the Right Honorable Lord Wolfe of Barnes, the former Lord Chief Justice of England and Wales Royal Courts of Justice, speaks on the topic of how to change litigation culture.
As an extremely fortunate in having been able to attend the global constitutional seminars here at Yale, which I know you know about, I think it's seven occasions now that I've attended, and I would like to put on record on a public occasion how excellent I think those seminars are. As you know, there are meetings between the law faculty and senior judges from a cross-section of jurisdictions. Such is the hospitality that you receive during those meetings that you feel part, albeit for only a short time, of the Yale family. It's my belief no other meeting of the judiciary and academia quite matches those seminars, which include an interchange with the students, which I was very happy to take part in today. Research will never reveal to what extent the dialogues that take place at the seminars has influenced the jurisprudence of the different jurisdictions from which the judicial delegates come. However, I am absolutely confident that it's substantial and highly positive, and I can say for myself that they've influenced my thinking, and I know that I'm not alone in this. The influence has been carried into many, many jurisdictions. I'm also regarded as a great privilege to have the opportunity of giving this lecture. Unfortunately, I did not know Justice Anderson, but everything that I've heard about him, including what I've just heard about the fact that he was appointed to judicial posts by two different administrations, makes it clear to me that he's a jurist of the highest caliber. And if confirmation of that is needed, there's two things to which I look. First of all, of course, it's wonderful to have the family represented here, and I'm very glad about that. But having had what we call judicial assistants, and you call clerks, to have two of your clerks to make the journey, or possibly three, to hear a lecture on this subject is indeed an indication of the quality of the man for whom the lectures are named. In addition, I know who my predecessors were. They are a role of honor which I feel hardly justified in joining. And I'm particularly pleased that my friend, Justice Abella from Canada, the Canadian Supreme Court, who gave last year's lecture, is here with us. To United Kingdom eyes, I suspect what I'm going to talk about is not a subject that turns on students or indeed lawyers. Indeed, it would be more accurate to say it's a turn-off. So I'm quite surprised by the audience that I see. I did receive apologies from quite a number of my colleagues on the seminar, and I wouldn't have been surprised if my experience had not been similar to an old friend who was a judge of great experience, who recently, I'm very happy to say alive, but had been ill, and who had an invitation to go to Manchester to give a lecture. Well, as you probably know, Manchester is a soccer-mad city, and before he went on his journey up from London, he had a phone call from the person who's going to chair his lecture, saying, Judge King Hamilton, perhaps it would be a good idea if we cancelled the lecture because Manchester United have got a replay in an important cup match and the audience might be a bit small. Well, Alan King Hamilton wasn't going to be put off by this. He'd got his ticket and he was ready to go. And he said, no, I don't mind going. Anyway, the chairman very gallantly met him at the station and took him to where the lecture was going to take place. And as they were pulling up, he said, Judge, I'm awfully sorry. I'm afraid I've got another engagement. but But I'm sure the lecture will go well. Alan went into the hall, and it was not too large a hall, fortunately, because there was only one other person there. Anyway, Alan gave his lecture, and when he came to finish it, he started to walk down from the sort of situation I'm in, and the one person said, Judge, would you mind waiting just a short time? And Alan said, why? He said, I'm the other speaker. This would not happen in Yale, quite obviously. And even civil procedure is a subject which I know from the class I attended this morning and from the distinguished civil proceduralists who are here present this afternoon, that they take, and rightly take, very serious. In my view, civil procedure goes absolutely to the heart of justice. And it's no point in having rights. It's no point in having excellent judges, no point in having superb buildings, no point in having powerful methods of enforcing judgments if the ordinary citizen, and it's the ordinary citizen who I'm primarily concerned, whether he be claimant or defendant, unable to obtain access to a proper resolution of his or her dispute. I emphasize that way I put it. That includes, of course, for those cases which need it, access to courts. And it was the fact that although in England we've had a very mature legal system which had been evolving over the centuries and indeed had been the subject of many reports. I think there were 50 reports prior to my report in the previous century, in the previous 100 years. And the system still cannot produce justice. When I was asked, as you've heard, by the Lord Chancellor to do my report, there had been a number of other recent assessments of the situation. And one very distinguished commentator described the situation as being one of crisis. And it was a crisis despite the quality of the judiciary and indeed the profession. And what was wrong was that the system had not kept up with the needs of the public. It was excessively adversarial. It gave the impression, and probably was, run for the convenience of lawyers. It was excessively expensive. It was extraordinarily complex. And it was unnecessarily confrontational and destructive. And after I'd been appointed, I took an assessment as to what was the way forward. Was it a situation where further reform could make the system work better? Or was it a situation where really we had to start again at the beginning and tackle the fundamentals and adopt what is sometimes described, in my country at any rate, as a big bang approach, producing a new system which, although new, took into account the existing system, but was fundamentally different from that system. I rapidly came to the conclusion that that was the right course. I appreciate that in adopting that sort of approach, I was perhaps following in the footsteps of what happened in this country when those responsible for the 1938 federal civil procedure rules decided to bring out a new code. But certainly in a system as old as mine, to take the approach that I was adopting was ambitious, some would say reckless. However, prior to my doing so, I had consulted widely with members of the profession and the judiciary, and also public interest bodies who were concerned with the system. And I was sure that what was needed was a new approach, because what was at heart a problem was of a cultural nature. And if you're going to change the culture, it's no use fiddling with the edges. You've got to convince everyone that something's going to be different. And in fact, I was very fortunate that I managed to convince the profession and my colleagues on the bench that that was going to be the situation. And I have to say and have to acknowledge, both were very receptive to the changes that I was proposing. Though I have to say that there was one or two of my colleagues who reminded me of the 18th century judge who's reputed to have said, "Reform, reform, things are bad enough already without reform." It was beside the scale, it was because of the scale of the crisis that I decided to produce two reports, an interim and final report. And the idea was that after the interim report, there would be an opportunity to consult widely on the recommendations that I was intending to make. And the idea was to get the profession and the judiciary on board. And I believe that the consultation was very important. But I didn't only consult with the judiciary and the profession, I consulted with the public. And up and down my jurisdiction, with my colleagues, I held seminars where local practitioners, local judges, and the public were invited. And the media took this on board and were very supportive, and they began to build up a pressure for reform, which was the sort of setting in which real change could take place. For an audience to understand the context of my reforms, it's helpful to keep in mind that our two systems could be said to be a single system divided by two different approaches. First of all, with the exception of defamation proceedings or primary defamation proceedings, there are no juries in English civil proceedings. And I just to give an example how that alters the situation, we had complex rules of evidence. There were professors who spent their whole time researching and writing about evidence and teaching evidence. But rules of evidence had been devised, in my view, my chairman this evening, who's a legal historian, may disagree with me, but they had been the byproduct of the fact that our system was one hitherto which had been a jury system. And the rules of evidence really are intended to help a non-trained lawyers properly to assess the issues before them. It's important that they're protected from irrelevant evidence and inadmissible evidence, and it's important they get the very best evidence which is available rather than second-hand evidence, because they may not be in a position to make the appropriate discount for the nature of the evidence. But in my view, this was really a situation in the past. Indeed, it's my belief that contemporary juries are well able to distinguish between hearsay evidence and first-hand evidence, and to exclude all hearsay evidence, it doesn't help the achievement of justice. But one of the reforms that came in as a result of my report was to give a total discretion to the judge to let any evidence in. And he or she would do so according to what weight they thought could, if any weight, be placed upon the evidence. and they were well able to make the necessary discount. Well, that in itself was a simplification which was important. Secondly, with regard to distinctions between your system and mine, is we have a cost-shifting rule. Now, this is a very powerful weapon in the hands of the judiciary to be able to ensure that judges are able to impose sanctions to ensure compliance with their orders. I was mentioning earlier today that in Singapore, the Chief Justice there went further, and he actually sent a lawyer to prison who didn't attend two of his case management hearings. I wasn't going to go as far as that, but I didn't need to because of the cost-shifting rules. And when I talk about cost-shifting rules, what I mean is a rule whereby the losing party not only has to pay their own costs, but in general has to pay the costs of the other party as well. That is, what are the tax costs? We have a system of taxation, and you would get normally two-thirds of your costs from the other side if you succeed. And if parties don't observe the requirements, then you get special orders for costs. And special orders for costs can be made which require payment immediately. And it's very salutary for a lawyer to be told that he or she's got to pay the costs, so they have the choice of either paying them themselves or going to the client and saying, I didn't attend when I should have done, I didn't produce the documents when I should have done, and because of that, I've had to pay, that you've got to pay £200 or £300, or sometimes much larger sums if litigation is complex. The third distinction is one which was a handicap, but was necessary because of the nature of our judicial system, and that is we don't have a docket system. And it's very much more difficult to manage cases if you don't have a docket system, because cases do have to come before a judge on subsequent occasions if they are of a significant size. And except for the heaviest cases, we do not allocate a judge to a case from the outset. I would very much have wished to have been able to do that. Now, making allowance for those matters, I came, when I was conducting the report, to the North America and Canada and the USA. And I have to say, with regard to case management and ADR, I received very considerable assistance from what I found here. And those who know the detail of what I was recommending would see in many instances the fact that there is a North American influence. But in addition to looking at the common law systems, and we went to Australia as well as to North America, we looked, of course, at our neighbors across the channel in Europe, on the civil justice systems. Now, their systems are very different to ours. On the whole, their civil justice system gives very little prominence to the oral aspects, although there are oral aspects. Furthermore, one of the problems in our system, and one of the problems sometimes in your system, is linked to discovery. And discovery is really not known in the civil systems. Now, I certainly think that this discovery has great benefits, but it can be disproportionate, and it can hide the truth just as well as other systems can hide the truth if you want to distort the system. In these days, when you tend to have 6 or 7 or 10 copies of documents produced by your computer, discovery can be hugely burdensome, because often what a party will want in the English system is to examine all the 10 copies of each document to see if there's any change which might be useful for cross-examination. And so I thought that at least in the great majority of cases, a balance had to be struck between the contribution, the discovery in the, and the existing form in England, which did not involve the oral examination of witnesses, except in the most unusual circumstances, would contribute to a just result, and the extent to which it would just really increase the costs without materially altering the validity of the system. And my general conclusion was that we had to tighten up the obligations to make disclosure of documents, and that was one of my recommendations. And so there is a distinction, again, between the US approach and our approach. When I published my interim report, on the whole, there was favorable response. There were some who saw particular aspects that worried them, and I'm going to deal in a moment with one of those, which is particularly controversial, and that was my approach to experts. But perhaps before I do that, I should refer to Professor Marcus of the University of California, who gave an American reaction to my report. Perhaps he wasn't quite as generous as my chairman this evening. What he said, what he'd seen in my report reminded him of a famous remark attributed to the American baseball player Yogi Berra. This is deja vu all over again. But certainly that might be true to American eyes, but it wasn't true to English eyes. He did actually add that the suggestions were creative and thought provoking. The main thrust of the interim report was to change the role of the English judge. That traditionally was to act as a neutral arbitrator, leaving the parties to conduct the proceedings as they thought was most appropriate. And of course, they would say, and did say at that time, that they know much more about the case, particularly as we did not have a docket system, than anybody else, because they'd been responsible for bringing it. However, it seemed to me that the state of our system would not be rectified unless the judges were given the clear responsibility of actually producing a just result which was proportionate and not one which defeated the ends of justice because of the costs which were involved. There was plenty of evidence to support my report, to much support my view. There were cases of which I had personal experience of neighbors who were arguing over a boundary dispute when there might be only a few feet in dispute, and they both ended up selling their properties because that was the only way they could meet the costs that were involved. And there were medical or clinical negligence cases where the situation was really truly disturbing, largely because of problems with expert evidence. And as early as 1970, one of our most distinguished judges, Lord Devlin, described the situation in these terms: "The fallacy inherent in our High Court procedure of civil litigation is just that where justice is concerned, time and money are no object. We think of British justice as an ideal into which such sordid considerations ought not to enter. We refuse to associate with it such homely maxims as that half a loaf is better than no bread. But is it right to cling to a system that offers perfection for a few and nothing at all for the many?" And to that answer, to that proposition, I replied in a firmly negative terms. And so the interim report proposed that the system should become a managed system, with the judge clearly the manager. It was the responsibility of the judge to strive to provide justice for the individual litigation. And it, at the same time, it should be the clear responsibility of the parties and their advocates to help the judge to provide this. The judge had to cease to be a neutral, and he had to become a manager of a dispute resolution process. Echoing the revolving door courts that I'd seen in Washington, it might be that he would see justice provided by a court or by alternative forms of dispute resolution. If he thought that a dispute could be better resolved elsewhere, then it seemed to me it was at least his responsibility to advise the parties of this. In my view, he should not force the parties to go elsewhere, not order them to go elsewhere, but he should give them the benefit of his views and leave them to make a decision having had the benefit of that. In addition, the reforms placed responsibilities on the legal advisers to the parties to help the judge perform his role. And the judge was given a wider discretion in the litigation process, but he needed to know what the views were of counsel and the parties in order to properly exercise that wider discretion. Among the matters he was required, what the parties' lawyers were required to do, were first of all, from at the outset, to inform the parties of what might be the cost commitment, because there was substantial evidence available to the inquiry to the effect that parties were being sucked into litigation, where if they'd known what might be involved at the outset, they would have chosen not to be put in that position. The proceedings were taking over their lives, especially in relation to their finances. And it was that sort of problem that the new procedure rules were intended to deal with, to emphasize that they were a new approach. It was thought essential that at the outset we identified what we thought a civil justice system that is appropriate should be doing. And the new rules start off in part one with the announcement that it's a new procedural code. And that was a deliberate step taken to make it clear this was going to be a break from the past. The old rules, many of which were admirable, had been encrusted with precedents. And so it was no use just looking at the rule. In order to understand what the effect of the rule was, you had to examine a mass of authority. And it meant that the ordinary person was in a great disadvantage in controlling their own proceedings. Having set out that it was a new procedural code, part one goes on to say that there was an overriding objective of proceedings, which is to enable court to deal with cases justly. And this involves ensuring that the parties are on an equal footing. Secondly, saving expense. Thirdly, dealing with a case in a way which is proportionate to the amount of money involved, to the importance of the case, to the complexity of the issues, to the financial position of each party. And I would underline those last words, to the financial position of each party. Because what it was saying to the judge and the parties in the overriding objective, that you've got to take into account that some parties are wealthier than others. And it has to be managed in a way which enables both parties to take part in the proceedings according to the first requirement that they are on an equal footing. Then it goes on to say that they should be ensuring that the proceedings are dealt with expeditiously and fairly. And finally, there should be allotted to each case an appropriate share of the court's resources while taking into account the need to allocate resources to other cases. Probably the most important requirement in that list is that there should be a level playing field. The overriding object also recognizes, but what is obviously usually ignored, that the resources of a court system are inevitably limited. And if the parties conduct their litigation, either by constantly seeking adjournments or for any other reason, in a manner which is disproportionate, that can affect other litigants who are waiting to have their cases heard. And it is perfectly appropriate for the judge to take that out into account in deciding the outcome. Having set out the overriding objective, Part 1 then goes on clearly to place a duty on the judge to manage cases actively in accordance with the overriding objective, but also places the lawyers under a clear duty to perform that task. And placing the duty on the lawyers is very important. It's establishing that this is a partnership with the judge as senior partner. It also makes it clear that the obligation of the lawyers is not only to the client, it is also to the court. And in our system, that is a very fundamental requirement. Often, the lawyers do not necessarily appreciate that they must take into account the needs of justice as well as the needs of their client. Now, in both our systems, a great many actions settle. However, in our system, and I suspect possibly to some extent in your system, we are blighted, or had been blighted, by the fact that settlements often took place at a very late stage, and so doing consumed the maximum resources both of the court and the parties. This could cause distress to the parties and strain on the courts. The same is true of the commencement of cases which are without merit. This can be done in good faith, or it can be done merely as a tactic. And it was my intent that we should deal with both those problems and prevent, first of all, the use of litigation for collateral tactical reasons, and to ensure that parties would be in a position to settle early. Now, I've been a barrister. I know what it's like in practice. If you've got a trial next day and you've got other cases, you will always defer the other cases and deal with your trial next day. And it is one of the things, at least of the culture of English litigation, that barristers and solicitors, when they're the advocate in the case, tend to leave the preparation of cases close to the trial. And so they settle at the door of the court. And one of the things that I tried to do was to really create a virtual door of the court, as though it was for the trial, before the proceedings commenced. And so a feature of our proceedings process now, which I suspect is unusual, is that you can obtain orders from the court in regard to prospective proceedings. And what has happened is this. We developed the idea of a protocol, a pre-action protocol. We identified various kinds of litigation, and we got really experienced litigants and judges in that kind of litigation to work together and work out a sensible pre-action process in order to avoid the action starting, if at all possible. Usually, it's very difficult for the parties to decide whether a case should be fought or settled until they have the necessary information. The protocol ensures that both sides have the necessary information. And if necessary, the court can make orders to ensure that where that's not the case, that that happens. And the idea of settling the cases without litigation was further supported by both parties being in a position to make offers to settle. So the claimant would do so, the potential claimant would do so, and so would the potential defendant. And the offers to settle, again, take advantage of our cost-shifting rule. Because if you make an offer to settle and the other side doesn't accept it, then if they recover less than the offer to settle, they don't get their costs after the time they could have settled and didn't choose to do so. Equally, there are, if you're a defendant and you're if you're a claimant and you make an offer to settle, if the defendant doesn't accept it, then the situation is that you get, under the rules, not just an ordinary order for costs, you get an actual indemnity for your costs. And you also get interest, which is at a high rate, because you're being forced through the courts into litigation which you would rather have avoided, and for that purpose made the offer to settle. And so before the litigation starts, both parties tend now to make offers to settle, and so it's known what they are prepared to do, and an intelligent decision can be made as to whether the risks which are always inherent in litigation are worth undertaking. And I'm told, and I believe, and the research supports this, that the offers to settle, which can take place before litigation begins, or if necessary, after litigation started, has made a big difference. Now, what an aspect of the protocols is the lawyers are having to do a considerable amount of work before the proceedings start, which under the old system would be done much later. And this was a criticism, and it still is a criticism of the reforms, that you're front-loading costs, many of the costs which will be unnecessary. Now, I wear the criticism, I understand where it comes from, but it's my contention that if you're going to have an efficient managed system, that's a cost you have to pay. Normally, it's just a question of advancing the costs. But how can you settle a case properly until you're able to make a frank an assessment of what is involved? And the protocols enable that to be done. And if a party doesn't cooperate and follow the protocols, prima facie, unless there's good reason for the party not doing so, again, the party is punished for that. Now, litigation differs. You have simple cases, small cases, you have medium cases, and you have heavy cases. And because of this, the reforms identified three tracks. There was a small claims track, which is for cases up to £5,000, let's say $8,000. Those cases are dealt with extremely quickly, within a month. There really is only necessary for the claimant to fill out a document. There's then, in the majority of cases, an obligation for the defendant to say whether he admits or disputes the claim, or if he disputes the claim, to set out the reasons why. And they come before the judge, and the judge does justice within an hour on those documents. It's designed to be dealt with by litigants themselves, and it has been very successful, as illustrated by the take-up. There's been about 60,000 cases a year on the last figures which were given. And the remarkable thing about the small claims procedure is the cases, unlike other cases, don't settle. And the reason, of course, is that the parties can manage it themselves. They don't have to have lawyers. And equally, it's right to say, they don't have the cost implication. So that's the small claims. Then we had what was called the fast track. And this was for the majority of litigation, most of it which was personal injury litigation. And that was intended to come to a trial which would only take place in one day, within a period of about 6 months. And it was the procedure was carefully defined so that only limited effort was required to be made. I recommended that procedure should be at a fixed cost so far as the lawyers were concerned. But that was a step too far for the government. But I'm glad to say that we have come now to a situation where, again, there's a protocol and there's now a standard cost for the personal injury actions, which were a bulk of the sort of cases we had within our system. And those cases are just disappearing. And there were cases which really clogged up the system before. And they should have been and could be capable of easy resolution. So with the offers to settle and the tracks, we had to tackle the experts. And what I believe was the situation in this country, it was true in my country. There was an excessive use of experts. And you never had one expert for the both sides. You had experts in numbers, and they were hired guns. They were there really to advance the arguments which the lawyers would advance. And so we tried to break this by saying, normally the parties would only have one expert for both sides. This had a very salutary effect on the expert witness industry. Because if you could only be employed for both sides, it was no use getting a reputation of being a claimant's or a defendant's expert, because if you were a claimant's expert, the defendants wouldn't agree to you, and if you were a defendant's expert, the claimant wouldn't instruct you. And as a result of this, we now have one expert in the majority of cases. But of course, it's the scale of the case which does this. If a case is complex, and if there are two, it's one of the areas where there is legitimately two different schools of thought, then of course the parties can have more than one expert. But you start off with the idea that there's a single expert. And if there are two experts, then the experts have to meet and record for the benefit of the judge the issues upon which they're agreed and the issues upon which there is disagreement. And they also have to assure the judge in their report that they have put in the report, which the judge will see, all matters which are relevant, not merely matters which are relevant to their client's case. They've got to put into account all matters, and they have to sign a declaration to this. And they also have to record what is in fact the case, that they are under a duty to the courts, just like the lawyers, to assist the court to do justice, and certainly should not mislead the court. Now, that, again, was, it seemed to me, an important step forward, because so often you would have cases, and I remember appearing cases myself where this happened, where what the expert was told influenced the report which they gave. And if they didn't know what the case of the other side was, of course they didn't give effect to that in their report. But when they got to the hearing, they would realize what the other side was saying, and again they would qualify the report that they'd given earlier. And we wanted to get the full reports at the outset. And you know, it's absolutely critical. And I can quote a case against myself under the old system. It's well known on in an area where I used to practice, the two lawyers that used to instruct me from time to time met to discuss settling a case. And one said, my counsel said, the case is worth X. And the other lawyer said, well, my counsel said it was worth 2X. And very sensibly, they agreed to exchange opinions of counsel. The only unusual thing was it was the same counsel who had assigned both opinions. Now, I don't think that's any reflection on my qualities as an advocate. It wasn't because I was not trying to give an objective assessment, with no purpose in my doing other than give an objective assessment. But of course, if I only heard one side of the story, and when I came to give the other opinion, had forgotten that side of the story, then my answer is going to be different, and that's what happened. Now, Research into a reform process of this sort is very important. Indeed, I'm told that in the Oliver Wendell Holmes emphasized the importance of social research, and considerable efforts, I believe, were made in this great law school to give effect to that research. However, in England, our system had been very limited in the research that had taken place. But at least after my report, there was research carried out of a limited nature. And in particular, two professors, Professor Genn of UCL and Professor Zuckerman of Oxford, made reports, and they said they had convincing evidence that the overall number of settlements of claim as a result of the reforms had risen dramatically. In addition, the Lord Chancellor's Department carried out an evaluation, and that concluded that the reforms had provided a clearer structure, greater openness, and a cultural change in favor of settlement. And that, in accord with my reforms, there has been a take-up of ADR. Now, I am an enthusiast for ADR. Since I ceased to be Chief Justice, I've been trained as a mediator, and I have conducted mediations. But before doing that, I was already an enthusiast. And I do believe that justice can be achieved in mediation of a nature which cannot be provided by the courts, and that the prospects of both sides going away more content with the outcome from ADR is greater than that when they go before the courts. I do, however, believe it should be voluntary. I also believe that it shouldn't be an excuse for not being able to dispose of the cases in the court's calendar. I'm happy to report that there has been a considerable take-up of ADR in England, but nothing like to the extent I believe it should be. Now, before I turn to the final part of my talk, where I will try to say something more about how successful the reforms have been, I would mention three areas where there have been problems. The first is in relation to the provision of IT to support the reforms. What I wished to do was to produce a court system which ran wholly on IT unless something went wrong with the IT. Unfortunately, the resources for that have never been provided. And I was very interested to hear today in the class I attended that Israel is now going to embark upon such a system. And so Singapore, which is another small jurisdiction, has had it for years. And it does make a huge difference. And it gives the management system a great advantage. But anyway, there it is. We've got to manage with what we've got. And the position is that we've got to do without the IT we need, although slowly judges are getting more IT. In addition, the UK Treasury take the view that the civil justice system should pay for itself. Now, this is an extraordinary idea, and I've said so publicly, so I don't mind saying so here. But this has become embedded in concrete within the Treasury as a principle of government, that government shouldn't have to pay for civil justice. How they can take that view, I do not know. The House of Lords doesn't decide cases for the parties that are before them. It decides them because of the public interest in the law being developed and expanded. At any rate, that's what they try to do. And you can understand why, in those circumstances, my reforms haven't helped the financing of the system because they've reduced the number of cases coming before the courts in which the Treasury can get fees. And so it's a self-defeating exercise. But at any rate, the judges have protested and continue to protest, but that's how matters remain. And if there is not a change, eventually there will be great difficulties. The other thing I have to mention is legal aid. We had in the UK an excellent provision of legal aid for civil justice. It was quite simple. There was a means test above which you didn't get legal aid. But if you were below the means test, you might have to make a contribution. But basically, you would get legal aid if you had a case which had a real prospect of success. And that meant that at least those who were the poorest members of the community could always bring litigation with the help of legal aid. There were still those in the middle who couldn't afford it. Those who were at the top of the pecking order, of course, probably could afford it. At any rate, at the same time as the government decided to reduce legal aid in civil proceedings to control the costs, they introduced what are called conditional fees. Now, contingency fees had been regarded in the UK as contrary to public policy. It was thought that they had a very deleterious effect on the delivery of justice, and it was felt that lawyers should not be sharing in the proceeds of the case. Conditional fees differ from contingency fees in that they don't depend on the lawyer being paid out of the proceeds of the case. But what they do mean is that the client doesn't pay if the client loses. But if he or she wins, then they have to pay not only the normal fee, but a normal fee plus an uplift. And the uplift could be as much as 100%. And that is obviously a real factor which affects claimants, because it means they get less damages. So they then take out insurance to cover that contingency. So they pay for the insurance in those circumstances. Now, the poor defendant who appears against a conditional fee client, if they lose, have to pay not only the normal costs of the claimant, but the uplift and the insurance fee. And it's my concern that that burden is so extensive that it really puts undue pressure on defendants to settle. Now, I'm all in favor, as you know, for settlement, but we don't want to have a situation where parties are really in a position where they can't afford to fight cases. And even the insurance companies sometimes are entitled to a little bit of sympathy in respect of claims which are made. At any rate, it has had the effect of changing insurers' attitude. They try to settle cases as soon as they possibly can. So, in my final report, I set out what the new landscape I was seeking to create would involve. First, that litigation would be avoided wherever possible. Secondly, litigation would be less adversarial and more cooperative. Thirdly, litigation would be less complex. Fourth, the timescale of litigation would be shorter and more certain. Fifthly, the cost of litigation would be more affordable, more predictable, and more proportionate to the value and complexity of the individual cases. Six, the parties of limited financial means would be able to conduct litigation on a more equal footing. Seven, there would be clear lines of judicial and administrative responsibilities. Eight, the structure of the courts and the deployment of judges would be designed to meet the needs of litigants. Nine, that judges would be deployed effectively so that they could manage litigation. And tenthly, that the civil justice system would be responsive to the needs of litigant. This is a formidable list, but its combined effect demonstrates the change of culture which I was seeking. And the view now is that on the whole, that is a new landscape which applies to the proceedings in England, with one exception. That remains a problem over costs. Costs are the cases that don't settle. And there has been no real reduction evidenced in the cost of the proceedings which don't settle and go full way. And equally it's true that there's a problem with front loading. But my reforms were not designed to cut lawyers' fees. What they were designed to do was to reduce the time the cases took, and therefore the amount of work which lawyers had to do for that reason. There have been cases in England recently which have caused a lot of public criticism. They were very large cases. There was a case against the Bank of England, which the Bank of England was determined to fight, where it said the costs of the Bank of England alone were 100 million pounds, not dollars. And that is, so we're talking about nearly 200 million pounds. It's an almost unbelievable sum. But the litigation was hugely complex. The Bank of England and those who were against them went to a great number of top lawyers who charged top fees, and they conducted the litigation as though money was no object. They were determined to win because they took the view that the reputation of the Bank of England was a total at risk. The other side was a bank in liquidation, and the liquidators were equally determined to win. They did not believe that the Bank of England would fight the case. And no side really made any effort to control what happened. The judge was criticized, but he was put in a difficult position because the case, first of all, he declared was one, not her, his predecessor had declared was one entirely without merit and had struck the case out. It had gone up to the House of Lords, and the House of Lords, by 3-2, said the defendant, the claimant should have the right to go to trial. And they went to trial, and the length of it was over a year. Most of the time was an oral argument. There were lorry loads of documents. It was an appalling situation. I was surprised the case could be tried at all, but still the price of which was paid by the parties, and primarily by the losing party, is one which caused me horror and I thought was a reflection on the English legal system. However, it was not the sort of case which my report was primarily intended to deal with. I don't think that if parties as sophisticated as the Bank of England or the liquidators, who are a very large firm of accountants, choose to conduct litigation in that way, there is nothing that the parties really can be forced to do which prevents them from doing what they want to do. You can try, and the judge tried to curtail it, but this was the consequence. And I've got to add to that story before I leave it, the case actually never went to a conclusion, because after months and months of hearing, eventually the claimants threw in their hand and accepted that the case had no merit. Now, what do you do about that? I don't know. I only hope that there will never be any repetition of a case of that sort. It's still my contention that the system as a whole is better as a result of the changes that have occurred. In saying that, I am very conscious that two very distinguished professors of this law school would be worried about the system that I have been talking about. In particular, I know that my very good friend Judith Resnick is concerned that if you don't have enough cases going through the system, or if the system comes too closed, nobody can see what's happening and it can lead to abuse. I recognize the dangers she describes. It's my hope that they don't apply to the English system as it is now, but she might take a different view. But certainly her criticisms and those of Professor Fiss have to be taken into account, and the physician has to be watched. For that purpose, we have two bodies who are responsible for doing the watching. We have a body called the Civil Justice Council, which has a broad representation of those who have interests in this field, who keep the system under review and make recommendations and report to Parliament on it. We also have a procedure rule committee, which changes the rules as they need to be with experience. You learn by experience. And I hope that those two bodies will avoid the dangers that the professors have identified. The way I would sum up my system is that it's perched midway between the civil courts of the Europe and the traditional common law courts. I like to think it is a common law court with a French accent. But whether that be right or not is for others to judge. But certainly it has learnt from the civil system, and to that extent indicates how two different systems can help each other. Now, I ended on a gloomy note, so will you forgive me if I tell you a little story to end up with? It's about the fact that and it shows that judges, even at the highest level, are still human, and that advocates still have one or two tricks up their sleeve. A very distinguished advocate at the English Bar was Mr. Samuel Stamler, and he was representing a client in a fraud case who had the misfortune to look like the crook that he was. And he lost his case at first instance, and he insisted on going to appeal. Reluctantly, Mr. Stamler represented him on the appeal, and he lost in the Court of Appeal. And he then wanted to go to the House of Lords. Mr. Stamler explained to the client that the situation was one where he had to get permission to appeal to the House of Lords, as you do with your certiorari, and in Mr. Stamler's view, you would not get permission to appeal. But the client said, well, I want you to try to get leave, and I'm prepared to take the consequences. And Mr. Stamler felt, therefore, he had to make an application. But he thought, at least I'll keep the client away from the leave application so the House of Lords don't see him when he makes the application, because they would draw the necessary conclusion. But the client was not to be deterred, and on the morning of the leave application, he turned up. And Mr. Stamler started off, and the lordships were extraordinarily sympathetic. And eventually he got leave. And he walked out of court with the counsel on the other side. And the other said, counsel said, what was wrong with their lordships today, Sam? They only had to look at your client to know he was a crook. And Sam said, I know. That's why I told him to sit behind you. Well, thank you very much for being so courteous.
Lord Wolf delivered this lecture at Yale Law School on September 18th, 2006.